secret afternoon. So, last time, we started off by talking about how rights and caches worked. And after going over our write policies, you mentioned, well, you know, it seemed like write through had this problem where we would always need to wait for the next level of cache every time we had a write, and even write back had this problem where whenever we evicted something, it would take extra long if that evicted thing was dirty because we'd have to write it back to the next level and also read in the next thing, and we know the next level is slow. We learned that there's this sort of fix for this where we have a small, what we call a write buffer, that stores pending writes. And we consider our write completed when it's in the buffer, and we can kind of actually do the write to the next level in the background. And as long as we don't run out of space in this buffer, this will hide the latency of those write operations. So as long as we're not doing too many writes, so many that the buffer gets filled up, this kind of makes those writes sort of complete instantaneously. Of course, you know, if we do enough writes, the buffer will fill up, but you know, hopefully, especially with like a write back cache, that's just not gonna happen. We also talked a bit about cache hierarchies, mentioning that sort of on a typical processor, we have not only our data and instruction cache, we have sort of our many levels of cache. We have a problem that we're kind of ignoring in this class called cache coherency of, well, how do we keep all our caches in sync? Then we started looking at some cache performance issues. We started with sort of a general notion of, okay, how do I kind of measure the performance of a cache and reason about, you know, what type of effect different design decisions have? And a way we have of thinking this was this average memory access time formula. And this had a component of hit time, so how long a cache takes when we have a hit in the cache, which is going to depend on like how big it is and how complicated it is to do our tag comparisons. What's our miss penalty? So if we have a cache and we don't have a hit, what additional time are we going to take to actually complete the memory access? So that mostly depends on what's at the next level. And our miss rate, how often are we going to have a hit? And we learned that a lot of our cache design decisions are kind of trade-offs. Like if we make our cache have more data, that's going to increase the hit time because it's just bigger and it's slower to read out of a bigger cache memory. But it's going to decrease the miss rate, increase the hit rate. So after looking at that notion of sort of general ideas of cache performance, we started thinking about how we can correlate cache performance to C code, which is going to be kind of our main focus today. We mentioned that you can kind of track the contents of the cache, and you know, one thing we want to think about is, you know, if we're reading values in our C code, how does that correspond to cache blocks? And one thing we notice is that it's real bad if it's not what we call a line, if our values kind of cross over cache blocks. And we learn that compilers generally, you know, lay things out in memory, so that usually doesn't happen. And we mentioned that if we want to sort of manually figure out what a piece of C code does, we can find the cache accesses. Remember that accesses to registers don't use the cache. But we find the actual cache accesses, and we can look at each set individually. So if we know some accesses go to a set with index 0 in the cache, we can look at them together and figure out the hits and misses without caring about anything else, because each of the sets kind of operates independently. And this can make it practical to think about sort of very large caches and how they correspond to C code. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes.
So early in the semester, we noted about the virtualization of memory when different programs are running at the same time. Does the same kind of concept apply when different programs are running in cache?
So the question is, we mentioned early in the semester that the actual memory addresses we see in our program aren't the real memory addresses. And the question is, do we have some sort of remapping for the cache? So the typical design these days is that mapping from the what we call virtual addresses, the addresses program sees, to addresses that are used by the actual memory happens before the caches. There are some systems which use a design where it happens after the caches, in which case there's extra work when we're switching between programs. But the the majority, more than majority, almost everything you'll use today does that translation before anything gets to the cache, so the cache is only seeing the real memory addresses. Other questions? Yes. Can I go over the cache hierarchy? So, sure. So typically, sort of on a processor, we'll have, you know, a data and instruction cache that have a common, in a modern design, usually an L2 cache they talk to. And this will be for each core. So we'll have multiple cores, which will typically share an L3 cache. This is kind of the consensus design of current desktop processors. It might change in the future. But we have this hierarchy where we have lots of caches. So I mentioned on my desktop, I have 4 cores. So I end up having 13 caches. I have 4 data caches, 4 instruction caches, 4 L2 caches, and 1 shared L3 cache. And something that needs to happen that we haven't gone into the details about is we need to worry about how do we keep all these in sync. If I write in one cache, how do the other caches know about that if the program tries to read from the thing that was just written? Other questions? Okay, so a logistical note. I'm out of town Monday through Thursday next week. My office hours on Monday and Wednesday won't be happening. Professor Trkanovich will be covering this lecture both Tuesday and Thursday. Okay. So I believe when we finished off last time, we were looking at not this example, but this example. Yes. Questions, will the lecture still be recorded? Yes. The recordings might take a little longer to go up for obvious reasons, but they should still be recorded. So let's got this exercise. So this is dealing with a 2-set direct graph cache. Remember our small cache sizes. And from last time, we determined that since this is 8-byte blocks and our array elements are 4 bytes, we have this kind of arrangement, and this is assuming array 0 is at the beginning of a block. So, you know, what we'd say that the 0 and 1 in the array are in set 0, 2 and 3 are in set 1, and so on. And that's sort of how we'd go about analyzing what happens here. So, question is, how many misses are there? Remember what we did last time is we just track the contents of each block, and we can like just to look at what happens in set 0, so each set rather, what happens in set 0. We can go through the accesses that touch set 0 to do that, and then do the same for set 1. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, so we're good. So who thinks there's going to be 2 or 3 misses? 4 or 5 misses? 6 or 7 misses? 8 or 9 misses. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus, and I would get 8 misses. And how I get that is I can keep track of the contents of each set, and basically what happens in set 0, which we can look at kind of independently, we can just look at the accesses that touch set 0, is we access 0, that brings in 0 and 1, we access 4, that brings in 4 and 5, and then we access 1, but unfortunately we just brought in 4 and 5, we only have one block in the set, so that means we're going to have a miss every time. And the other set is sort of symmetric here. You know, if we had a different number of indices, maybe it wouldn't be, but it's symmetric, so we get the same kind of result, just with different numbers, because our access pattern is very regular. So questions about how I figured this out? Okay, so we're comfortable with that. So let's extend this to something much bigger. So here I'm saying we have a 2 kilobyte cache, and we have 16-byte blocks instead of 8-byte blocks. It's a very similar pattern to our first example. The question is, how many misses do we have? And let's assume array 0 is at the beginning of a block. Okay, so who'd like more time? Okay, so who thinks we have less than 100 misses? Between 100 and 200? 200 and 300? Okay. Between 400 and 600? More than 600? So we have consensus that it's between 200 and 300, and I would get 256 misses. And one way I can think about this is I say we have a 2 kilobyte cache, and if it's a direct map cache, so there's one column. So that column has 2 kilobytes of data. And we put, if we have contiguous memory, we put the first byte of memory at the top of the column, and as we're going further in memory, we just go down until we get to through 2 kilobytes, and then we have to wrap around to the top again. So I know that two values that are 2 kilobytes apart are going to map to the same set, the same row of that cache. And if I translate that to array indices, I know that that means that values that are 512 bytes apart are going to map to the same set. Sorry, 512 entries apart, which is 2 kilobytes. And so from that, I can realize that, 0, 1, 2, and 3 is going to be the block containing array 0. We know there's 4 things in a block because of 16-byte blocks. And that's going to be in the same set as 512, 513, 514, 515. And similarly, the set containing 508, 509, 510, and 511 is the same as the one containing 1020, 1021, 1022, 1023, the one at the end of the array. So this means that every single block in the array, because it's exactly twice the size of the cache, and this is direct map cache, ends up having sort of 2 things that want to be stored in it. And, well, each block is actually only accessed once. So the easy way of solving this problem is I could just say, each block's accessed once. How many blocks are there? Well, there's 4k bytes in the array divided by 16 bytes, there's 256 of them. I could have also said, if I look at any one set, I always access one block 4 times, and then another block 4 times, and that's it. So I have a miss, hit, 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 miss, hit, hit, hit for those accesses to each set. So I have 2 misses per set, 128 sets. So I get 256 misses that way. So probably the easier way of figuring it out was just saying, oh, there's only one access to each block. It doesn't matter how it gets mapped because we're accessing the block, you know, without accessing anything else in between. Another way I could have figured it out is I could have just said, let's look at what happens to a typical set. And, oh, all the sets look the same in this case. So that just gives us our total count. Questions about either way of figuring that out? Okay, so let's do the same variation we've done before. How many misses do we have here? And the second question is, would changing this to set associative help? Instead of direct mapped. Okay, who would like more time for the first question here? Okay, so who thinks we have, say, less than 300 misses? Okay, couple. Who thinks between 300 and 500? 500 and 700? That's our majority answer. More than 700? Okay, so I would get 512 misses. So what happens here? So let's think about what happens in, as just to start out, set 0. So in this loop, we access 0, 2, 512, 514. And then in this loop, we access 1, 3, 513, 515, which are in that set. So we have the same kind of pattern we've seen before of we're going to bring in 0 through 3. So we're going to have a miss to bring in 0 through 3 on 0, and then a hit on 2. And then we're going to bring in 512 through 515, have a miss and another hit. And that's going to repeat. That even though we access 1 and 3, which we brought in when we brought in 0, unfortunately, we access something else that goes to the same set in between, and it's direct map. So there's only one thing that we can put there. So we had to evict 0 through 3. So every other iteration of these loops is a miss, and there's 512 iterations in each of the loops. So that gives us 512 misses. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay. So let's go to the second part. Would a set associative cache be better? So let's say we instead of having a 2 kilobyte direct map cache, we have a 2 kilobyte two-way or four-way or eight-way direct map cache. Would that be better? Who thinks yes, it would? We have less misses. Thinks no, it wouldn't. Okay, so we have about a split. And the answer is it would not be. And the problem is that if we're keeping the total size of the cache the same, as we add ways, we have to decrease the number of sets. So for example, with a two-way cache, we'd end up with accessing 0, 2, and then 256 would have to map to the same set because we have half the number of sets. And then we'd access 512, 514. And when we access 512, 514, we're going to probably try to evict the least recently used thing. What's that going to be? That's going to be the 0 through 3 block, which means it won't be available later on. And when we keep going, we're going to access, say, 768 and 770. And that's going to end up evicting the 256 block, because that's now the least recently used thing that's going to be left. And this means that when we get to our second loop, we access 1 and 3. That's going to be a miss again. We access 257 and 259. That's going to be a miss again. And accessing these is going to evict the 512 and 768 block again, even though we're about to access them later on in the second loop. So we end up with the exact same number of misses with an LRU policy. Yes?
Where is the 512 again? Where that's coming from?
Where's the 512 coming from? Which 512? As an array index or as a total? So question, is the 512 the number of sets? So 512 is the number of array elements that we can store in a column, in a way of the cache, in the direct map cache. And we know that because it's a 2 kilobyte cache. It has one column, one way. So that holds 2 kilobytes divided by 4 is 512 array elements. And so therefore, I know that if two things are 512 array elements apart, they must map to the same set. because we'll wrap around and call. With the two-way cache, our columns are half as big, so things which are 256 array elements apart will map to the same set. Yes? Question is, there will be 127 sets for a one-way cache. There will be 128 sets. Yeah. Yes, and the two-way cache of the same size would have 64. Now, if we made our cache bigger, so if we, you know, so made a, you know, a two-way cache that was a 4K cache, so the ways were the same size, then of course we'd have actually have less misses. But when we just increase the number of ways by decreasing the number of sets, doesn't always work out that way. And I guess something I didn't go over in detail is that I have to show is that, you know, I showed you what happened for set zero. I have to show that all the other sets are the same, but we know this problem works out that it's like exactly, you know, goes through all the sets. But like if I changed 1024 to 1000, things would be different. Yes. Question, if I made the cache 4 kilobytes but didn't make it associative, how would that affect the answer? That would lower the number of misses because we wouldn't have this phenomenon where two different parts of the array map to the same set anymore. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Would a set associative
cache be better here? No, because we aren't accessing we aren't accessing blocks twice. So not in terms of miss rate. Yeah, for this. We need a different access pattern to see than what I've shown you here to see set associated caches being advantageous. And in fact, I showed you with a two-way cache, but the same logic applies if I like go all the way up to a 128-way cache. Other questions? Okay, so I've shown you the technique for sort of manually analyzing accesses, and we can do that, but it gets very tedious. So I'm going to focus on sort of alternatives to this that are going to be less precise. So we're going to ignore some things. And we're going to look more at especially code with loops. We're going to look at where we have good temporal and spatial locality and focus on the inner loop to try to get a quicker count of misses that's going to be less accurate, but something that we can practically do for a lot of code without going through a lot of tedium of like exactly computing what's in each set and so on. Like computing what's in each set, useful to be able to do, but you know, not something that we're often, you know, able to actually do for, you know, time-wise. So start out, let's look at this code here. So we have three arrays, A, B, and C. And I have two versions of this loop. They differ in whether we iterate over I in the outermost loop or the innermost loop. And my question is, which of these has better temporal locality for the accesses to A, for B, for C, and the same thing for spatial locality? you'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with temporal locality in A. Who thinks version 1 is better? Okay, who thinks version 2 is better? Thinks they're about the same? Okay, so we have our consensus on version 1 for that. How about for B? Who thinks version 1 is better? Version 2? Okay, about the same. So we have pretty good consensus on 2. How about for C? Who thinks version 1 is better? Version 2? About the same? Okay, so these all agree with my answer. So what we look at is what the access pattern is in the innermost loop. And if we think about version 1, what we're doing is we're accessing A of 0, A of 0, A of 0, A of 0, and so on until J goes to N. So we do this N times. And then we're going to access A of 1, A of 1, and so on, again, N times. So most of the time, when we see an access to A, we're going to access the exact same thing real soon. So that's very good temporal locality. Versus here, where our access pattern is A of 0, A of 1, and so on up to A of N minus 1, then A of 0. So we are going to access A of 0 or anything else we see in A again soon, but, well, not soon, but eventually, but it's going to be after N other accesses to A. And the B is the inverse case. Now, as for C, I think most of you figured out that it's the same, and the reason why we say it's the same is because the way this indexing works out, we never access the same element of C twice. That we're, you know, if you think of ranging I, so J from 0 to N minus 1, you know, each I and J choose a unique element of C. So how about spatial locality? Who thinks we have better spatial locality in version 1 for A? Version 2? Okay, about the same. Okay, how about for B? Version 1? Version 2? About the same. Okay, how about for C? Version 1? Version 2? About the same. So, okay, so we have a bit of a split on C, and pretty good consensus in A and B. So I would say for A and B, spatial locality is usually not well enough defined when you're accessing something again. I've seen competing definitions. I would say it's about the same, that when we're accessing another element of A or B, it's always adjacent. But definitions differ on how to treat the case where we're accessing the exact same thing over and over again. So, so for C, we had a little less agreement than for the other questions. So if we look at the access pattern for C in version 1, that's going to be C of 0 times 0 plus 0, C of 0 times 0 plus, sorry, not 0, 0 times N plus 0, 0 times N plus 1, C of 0 times N plus 2, and so on. And then when we get to J equals N minus 1, we're going to go back to C of 1 times N plus 0, C of 1 times N plus 1, and so on. So it ends up that the access pattern for C in version 1 is C of 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way up to N squared, basically. So we're accessing the elements of C in order. So that's really good spatial locality. If we compare it to what happens in our second version, here we're going to be accessing C of 0 times N plus 0, then C of 1 times N plus 0, and C of 2 times N plus 0, and so on. And then when we wrap around, we're going to end up being accessing 0 times N plus 1, and so on, But we're skipping by n most of the time. So that's less good spatial locality. So with the first version, usually if I see an access to an element of C, we're going to access something that's one away. With the second version, usually we're going to access something that's about n away. So I would say that version 1 has better spatial locality. Some questions on how I figure that out? Yes? Can I go over the spatial locality for B? So in the case of both A and B, our access pattern is that we're accessing either like 0000000, then 11111, then 22222, or 012345 up to N, 012345 up to N. I would say that we would need a very precise definition of spatial locality to say which is really better. Because most definitions of spatial locality are kind of ambiguous about how do we treat accessing the same thing over and over. Is that like really good spatial locality or irrelevant? If you think it's irrelevant, they're about the same, right? We're always accessing something adjacent when we access something else. If you think accessing something over and over again is, you know, like accessing something that's adjacent, then maybe it's better. So that's why I left it as a tilde. This is not something when you read things about spatial locality, people will distinguish. Let's say they're both fine. Other questions? Okay. So we've kind of done this sort of qualitative thing of, you know, this one is better than the other in some ways and not others. Another thing we can try to do is we can try to estimate like actual numbers. So for example, I've taken one of our versions here, and let's think about the accesses to A. So in the loop over J, we're accessing the same element of A over and over again. So if there's going to be a miss there, we would expect the miss is only on the first iteration. It shouldn't be on any later iterations because we recently accessed the same element of A and therefore brought it into our cache. So we'd expect at most one miss to A per iteration of the inner loop. And about 3/4 of the time, if we think of the previous iteration of the loop, we access something that's in the same block because with this assumption here that there are 4 array elements per block. So if we choose a random element of A, then, you know, 3/4 of the time, the thing before it is in the same cache block. So about 3/4 of the time, we'd expect that, you know, the thing we access when J equals 0 is in the same block as the thing we accessed in the last execution of the J loop. So that means about 1/4 of the time that's not true and we'll have a miss. So I expect about 1/4 of a miss for every J loop to the for the accesses to A. There's n of those J loops executed, so I have n over 4 misses to A about. So this is an approximation because I'm not taking into account some things. Like I'm not actually like figuring out how the blocks work out in the array. Like maybe n is not a multiple of 4. I'm also not figuring out, are there going to be conflicts with the B and C's arrays? I'm just ignoring that to make my approximation, but because I'm ignoring that, I have to do a lot less work to actually like compute this number. And it's about as useful. Okay, so questions? How I figured that out? Okay. So the exercise here is to do the same thing for B and C. And one other assumption we'll need to use is that n is very large. So assume that because n is large, that I can't fit n elements of an array in the cache, meaning that if I access like 0 to n and go back to 0, I would expect that it's not in the cache still because n is so large, that I just can't put that much stuff in my cache. Something had to be evicted along the way. So given that, figure out how many misses we'd expect for B and C. Question? Question is, can we assume there are different caches? We're assuming that there's no conflicts between them, which is because this is, and that's by part of why it's an estimate, is that we're not going to take into account the what issues might happen from them mapping to the same set. I would note that with a typical cache that's not direct mapped, you know, it's likely that we won't run into any problems. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so we're good. So who thinks the answer for B is n times or divided by some small constant? Thinks it's n squared times or divided by some small constant? Thinks it's something else? Some people have no opinion, I guess. Okay. So you have squared. And how about for C? Who thinks the answer is n times or divided by some small constant? N squared times or divided by some small constant? Okay, so we have consensus that these are both something n squared-ish. And I would get n squared over 4 for both of these. So I'll start with C, because I think C is the simplest. So with C, we're accessing in any iteration of the loop, we're accessing something 3/4 of the time that's in the same block as what we accessed the iteration before. So 1/4 of the time that J loop is going to have a miss for each iteration. There's n squared iterations of the J loop, because there's n of the J. J goes from 0 to n, and I goes from 0 to n. So we end up with n squared over 4 misses to C. With B, the same sort of reasoning applies. 1/4 of the time, I'm accessing something that's in the same block as what I accessed before. When, you know, J equals 10, I've accessed J equals 9 before, B of 9, and that would be in the same block 3/4 of the time if I chose random elements of B. So again, we have n squared over 4 as the reasoning, and I'm accessing like B of 0 twice, but since n is large, I know that in between when I access B of 0 the first time and the second time, I'm accessing so many other elements of B before going back to the 0 element that I expect that 0 will be evicted. And the same is true of all the other elements of B. So that's why I don't get any advantage from accessing, you know, every element of B multiple times, other than, you know, the consecutive accesses being in the same block. Okay, so questions on my reasoning here? Okay, so let's start applying this to some less toy examples. And we're going to go through some examples with matrices, partly because matrices are the sort of thing where you care about cache performance because you're storing enough data. And I'm going to represent matrices as flat arrays. Rather than using sort of a 2D array syntax. There's two reasons for this. So one is that it's easier in C, since passing around a dynamically sized array in C is actually pretty awkward. Dynamically sized 2D array, rather, is pretty awkward. And another reason is that it's going to make it a lot clearer how the array maps to the cache. And I'm going to choose to use a convention that, you know, I'm going to say I times n plus j for what we would write as like ij indices. I could have done the other one. I just made a choice. And I'm going to call our first index I the row, the second one the column, meaning that the rows are stored together. I could have made the other choice. It's a perfectly valid choice. I just need to make a choice, and that's what I'm going to use for all these examples going forward. And to illustrate what I mean by the rows are stored together, here's sort of a matrix with that sort of indexing. So I have 0 times 0 plus 0, 0 times 5 plus 0, 0 times 5 plus 1, and so on for this 5 by 5 matrix. And if we imagine we had four element cache blocks, and let's say it starts at the beginning, you know, our cache blocks would look like this. So within a row, typically, so part of the row is likely to be in the same cache block, but it doesn't work out perfectly. And this is sort of what happens in reality, is that, you know, typically our data doesn't happen to have the same dimension as a power of two. So we end up with something like this. But note that, you know, if we're going rows at a time, we're going to get better performance because we'll have those extra hits from spatial locality. And we're going to consider as our running example a matrix multiply. So as a reminder, I think you've seen matrix multiply before, but or if you haven't, the formula for matrix multiply, you know, I have this sort of math formula. It's, you know, for every I and j in C, so we're going to choose a row and column of C, so we get a particular element of the matrix C, we're going to have the sum for all k of a element I comma k times b element k comma j. So that's what we can compute. And I've chosen to compute this in a particular order, but like with the example I showed you before with version 1 and version 2, we could change the order. So for example, I can choose to have the k be the inner loop, so I can choose to sum up all the things for a particular element of C together, or I could have it be the outer loop. I could choose that I'm going to deal with a particular k first and sweep over the entire set of output C for each k. And both are correct ways to do our matrix multiply. And we can do the same sort of analysis we did before on locality. So let's look at how the locality works here. So let's start with locality in C. So who thinks version 1 has better temporal locality in C than version 2? Version 2 has better temporal locality in C than version 1. No opinion, apparently. Okay. So no opinion? So let's look at what elements of C get accessed. So here, in this inner loop here, we're going to access, you know, C of 0, C of 0, C of 0, when I is 0 and J is 0. And we're going to do that until we finish all the K loops. So we're going to do that N times. And then J is going to advance to 1. And we're going to access C of 1, C of 1, C of 1, and so on. With this second loop, if we think of what happens as we begin, we're going to access C of 0, then C of 1, then C of 2, and all the way up to n minus 1 before going back, before going to C of n, and then C of n plus 1, n plus 2, and so on when I, when I becomes 1. And in fact, we're not going to access the same element of C again until k advances from 0 to 1, which is not going to happen until we go through all the I's and j's. So we have much better temporal locality in the first version for C. So questions on how I figure that out? So with the first version, we're accessing the same element of C as we accessed before most of the time. If we're like, we choose a random iteration of the inner loop, usually the element of C we're accessing, we just accessed before already. In the second version, we never have. In fact, we've never accessed it until way long ago. Okay, so which version has better temporal locality in A? so who thinks the who wants more time first? I should have done that the last time. Okay, so who thinks version 1 has better temporal locality in A? Version 2. So we have a plurality on version 2, and I would agree. And the reason why I say is that if we look at the axis pattern, like if we like try to write the numbers sequence of numbers we're going to get, we're going to, when k and I are 0, well, for every j, we're going to get the same, we're going to get a of 0 repeated n times. And then I is going to advance to 1, we're going to get a of n repeated n times. So most of the time, you know, n minus 1 over n of the time, so if n is anything non-trivial, that's a vast majority of the time, we're going to be accessing the same element of A we just accessed in the previous loop with the second version. With the first version, we're accessing adjacent elements, but they aren't the same thing. That's not a spatial locality, not temporal locality. So, you know, with the second version, we're accessing 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 in our sort of first loop. We're going, you know, if we look at our first few instances of the loop over K, we're going 0 through N, 0 through N, 0 through N, as long as I remains 0. And then we're going to do N through 2N, N through 2N, N through 2N, and so on. So we have some temporal locality in both cases, but it seems a lot better for version 2. Some questions on how I figure that out? Okay, so how about B? Which version has better temporal locality for B? Thanks. Who wants more time for that? Okay, a couple people. And I'm going to ask after that about spatial locality, so if you haven't thought about that, I'm going to get to that next. Okay, so who thinks the first version has better temporal locality for B? The second version? They're about the same? Okay, so yeah, I think about the same is fair. I think if we're comparing these, I would say that version 1 is worse because we never access the same element of B until I increments versus we do in version 2, but they're both very bad. So I would say, you know, version 1 is marginally worse temporal locality, but.
Can you explain that again?
So in order to, so let's say we're access B0, that's the first iteration, right? The only way we're going to access B0 again is if K and J are 0. And that's not going to happen until we increment I to 1. So that's why I say we never access it again. So I think it's clearly worse in version 1, but it's not good in either. And if n is large, we'd expect to get like no real advantage from the temporal locality. Okay, so how about spatial locality? So which of these has better spatial locality for B? If we'd like more time to answer. Apple, okay. So spatial locality for B. who thinks version 1 has better spatial locality. Version 2, about the same. Okay, so we have consensus on version 2, and I would agree, because in version 1, we're skipping by n between every access, because that's when k changes by 1, our index changes by n. In version 2, we're changing j, so when j changes by 1, our index changes by 1, so that's much better spatial locality. And sort of if we consolidate these, we can infer that probably, you know, there's better locality overall in the kij order than the ijk order. But there, you know, we have, you know, some disadvantage, you know, overall, like we got rid of the temporal locality when we switched to the kij order. So it's not, it's clear that it's definitely better. Yes. Question is, would spatial locality be better the tighter the axes are? I mean,
if they're right next to each other, it's better than if they're way apart.
So the question is, spatial locality better if they're right next to each other, it's better for spatial locality than they're far apart? Yes, that is the key sort of thing we're trying to measure when we say we have better or worse spatial locality. So one way we could visualize this is we can look at what happens in the inner loop, and I can just kind of draw on our picture of the matrix what happens. So this is with the ijk order. This is what we're accessing. And you can see how it corresponds to cache blocks, that we're going to get our spatial locality advantage for A, not really for B. And we have our big temporal locality advantage for C, where we're accessing the same thing over and over. And we can do the same analysis for the alternate order, where we're accessing the same thing in A over and over, and the same thing in the same one row of B and a row of C. And you see that this kind of intuitively tells us, oh, wait, we have, you know, all this good spatial locality that hopefully, you know, will mean that we'll access less cache blocks, therefore get better performance. And we can do, well, so one thing we can do is we can actually run it. So I did that. And I measured the number of instructions that executed and the number of cycles it took. And it was the same number of instructions? Well, because I just swapped K and I and J, so the assembly is essentially the same with different registers used in the loop logic. But the number of cycles is very different because sometimes we have more cache misses than other times. You can see it actually helped by about a factor of 2. So, questions? Okay, and I get no one asking about this thing here. Okay, interesting. So that's at 512, which is a multiple of 2. And at that size, when we do go down a column, we end up mapping to the same set over and over again, because when we add 512, we're going by about something that's related to the number of sets in the cache. So we get a lot of extra conflict misses for that exact size, but not the sizes around it. And that's also where we have like less prominent peaks and other things related to powers of 2. So a way we could have kind of guessed this besides writing it, though running it is probably what people do in practice, you could have done the same sort of miscounting analysis I showed you before on this code. So for the first version, I say, okay, let's look at A. Well, if we look at the K loop, you know, we're accessing things that are next to each other in A, so this is going to be, you know, n divided by the block size. So we have n accesses, and usually they're, you know, next to something in the same block. So it's just how many blocks do we have to bring in? Or alternately, we can think of it as 1 over the block size, you know, element size over the block size, percent of the time we have to bring in a new block. And we have n times where that might happen. So we got that many per k loop, which gives us n cubed divided by the block size. For B, in this case, we're skipping by n, so we're not going to have sort of any real advantage from accessing the same block, so we get about n cubed accesses. And for C, well, we have to bring in the value in C, and that's it. And often the value in C is the same thing we accessed in the previous J. So it's about n squared over the block size misses. And if we do the same exercise for version 2, well, our spatial locality tells us that, oh, this is probably a lot better than it was before when we just add up those numbers. And this isn't the way we could have guessed that that big performance difference would have happened. Though in practice, what people tend to do is they just try different orders and run it because, well, that's not too hard to do. So questions about this counting analysis? Just the same kind of counting we did before, so we could do that. Okay, so let's talk about something else. So something that may be unsatisfying here is that I kind of made a compromise where, you know, I took this really great number of misses for C, and when I changed the order, I made it a lot worse. It was a net benefit, but it kind of seems like we're making this uncomfortable trade-off. Can we do better? And the answer is yes. And I'm going to start by proposing a little transformation here. So I just took my original KIJ code, so the better ordering, and I said, let's just split the loop over K into two loops. So this clearly shouldn't change anything. We're still going from K from 0 to N. I'm just doing it in a funny way. So makes sense that this is the same so far? Okay. And just like before, I can decide this doesn't have to be the outermost loop. I can move it around. Just like I move the K loop from the inside to the outside, I can move the new loop I generated from the outside to the inside. So this is still the same, but I, you know, just move that K, that loop over two elements of K inside. And if we think of what I did to the locality here, so note that this loop over K only goes over two elements, so it's not really big. So what I did is I improved my locality in C. So previously, I was accessing an element of C and never not using it again for a long time. Here, I'm using an element of C twice before I get rid of it. And I also improved my spatial locality in A. Previously, I was like bringing in a block of A and accessing one element of it. Here I'm accessing probably two, because I'm accessing A of I times N plus K and A of I times N plus K plus one, you know, which should be next to each other probably in the same block. That's good spatial locality that I didn't have before, as obvious as much. And you know, so I'm getting some benefits. I'm making the spatial locality in B worse because, you know, B is now skips by N. I access two things from B that are N apart now. But it's just two, and I can control that it's just two. So it's not going to be so bad. And as long as I don't have this, you know, number be too high, this is still going to help my performance. So I've improved my overall locality by doing this, and I've sort of gotten rid of that problem we had of like, oh, I could have perfect locality in C and horrible locality in anything else, or perfect locality in something else and horrible locality in C. Here I'm getting like good locality in everything. I'm making some compromises, but I can kind of fine-tune that. So this is sort of something that Professor Stokanovich will extend on next time. But this is the basic idea of something we'll call cache blocking, where we're organizing our accesses very deliberately to kind of get the best mix of locality and to get better locality than we could do by just simply changing the loop orders. So So we've sort of improved our locality slightly. We've hurt some of our locality, but not as much as changing the loop order. And if we choose R2 carefully, we can do better. And we'll talk about, you know, sort of this more general version of this, where we'll do it for K, I, and J, and choose a number better than 2. And that's where I'll finish off this for today.